This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today, and thank you so much for listening. We have some big thoughts on national security and even free speech this hour. A former CIA officer pays the price for blowing the whistle against torture, and Congressman Steve Israel writes a satirical novel to try and deal with the very real risks of the surveillance state. And as we continue our week-long series of conversations with directors and writers ahead of the Oscars this Sunday, James Marsh, director of The Theory of Everything, joins the show, and we're asking you, who deserves an Oscar, who didn't get one or might not be nominated? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to weigh in. But first, after serving almost 2 years in a federal prison in Pennsylvania, former CIA agent John Kiriakou is back home in Virginia, where he's completing the rest of his sentence under house arrest. Kiriakou was imprisoned for leaking classified information to a reporter. He's the first CIA officer to be imprisoned for leaks or for any kind of wrongdoing at all in connection with the CIA's torture policies.
I want to be absolutely clear with our people and the world. The United States does not torture. It's against our laws and it's against our values. I have not authorized it and I will not authorize it.
That's President Bush, of course, speaking in 2006, denying the existence of the CIA's torture program. A year later, Kiriakou became the first CIA officer to publicly confirm the Bush administration's use of waterboarding. But there was a strategy shift after the Bush years. Shortly before he took office in 2009, President-elect Obama told ABC News that he didn't want to prosecute CIA officers who thought they were following lawful policies.
Obviously, we're going to be looking at past practices. I don't believe that anybody is above the law. On the other hand, I also have a belief that we need to look forward as opposed to looking backwards.
Well, despite that belief that we need to look forward, John Kiriakou was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison in January 2013. From his home in Virginia, John Kiriakou told me why he thinks he was targeted as the only official to be jailed for any reason relating to CIA torture.
I've maintained from the very beginning of my case that my case was not about leaking. It was about torture, that the CIA never forgave me for going public with a torture program, and they investigated me over the course of the next 4 years and just waited until I made a mistake, that the case was about torture, period.
So you were locked up for leaking the name of an operative to a reporter. That reporter never published the name, but you maintain that really it has nothing to do with that. They went after you because of your broader disclosures.
That's right. Washington runs on leaks, whether they're authorized or unauthorized. The last three directors of the CIA have not just leaked classified information, but they've leaked the names of covert operatives. There was no harm to the national security. There was certainly no criminal intent. Neither was there harm to the national security or criminal intent in my case. Yet I was prosecuted and they weren't. That leads me to believe that my case was not about leaking.
At the same time, as I mentioned, the president himself, President Obama, in 2009 was questioned directly about whether CIA operatives personnel such as yourself would be prosecuted. He said the answer was no.
Right. He said that that the Justice Department would not prosecute CIA officers who believed they were following the law. But I think that's not really the issue that we're facing today. The issue is, what about those officers who did not follow the law? What about those officers who went over and above what techniques had been approved in interrogations? We have several cases of CIA officers involved in interrogations where the prisoner died in CIA custody, yet still no one's been prosecuted.
Many of those cases are detailed in the Senate Intelligence Committee's widely distributed torture report, and we're going to get to that for sure in just a minute. Let's go back in history for a second, John Kiriakou. You were part of the team that found and eventually interrogated al-Qaeda leader Abu Zubaydah.
Correct, I was.
He was eventually waterboarded. Did you witness it?
I did not. I heard about it in the halls at the CIA after the fact, but I did not know at the time that he was being tortured, no.
So you heard about it in the halls from other colleagues, from coworkers. What did you think at the time?
At the time, I thought, well, al-Qaeda has promised that they would initiate an attack on the United States that would dwarf September 11th. And I thought, if this is the only way to save American lives, it's something that, we probably need to do. And then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, no, this isn't what we need to do. We were able to get Nazi war criminals to talk just by engaging them. And I thought that as Americans, we shouldn't be carrying out these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. We should let the professional FBI interrogators have their go at these prisoners before we do anything else.
Well, your experience gets to the very crux of what this debate had become in the United States, because you just maintain that waterboarding is wrong and illegal. Lots of people agree with you. The president of the United States agrees with you. But what about the yes, but part of this argument? It was argued all the time, and it's argued to this day by Dick Cheney and many others, that waterboarding yielded actionable intelligence, that attacks were imminent, and that it worked. What can you say to that?
I would say that that is just simply not true, and it's borne out in the 6 million documents that the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence poured through as part of their Senate torture report. There is simply no evidence that these torture techniques ever worked in developing actionable intelligence that saved American lives.
Did you try to go up the chain in the CIA or in the administration with your complaints, your concerns before going public?
I didn't. I had actually resigned from the CIA in early 2004, and I had moved to the private sector. But every time I heard an administration official or a former CIA official saying that we're not torturing, we don't torture, I knew that that was a lie. And then finally, when President Bush said, well, there may have been torture, but it was the result of a rogue CIA officer, that's when I decided to go public.
Now, the Senate Intelligence Committee report on the use of torture details a lot of the practices we've talked about, a lot of the practices that you blew the whistle on, and many other practices too: cold water, cold rooms, rectal feeding, and other terrible practices. Did you talk to Senate investigators? Were you a source for that report?
No, I was not. There was an earlier Senate Armed Services Committee report for which I was questioned. But no, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence never approached me.
Were you surprised that they didn't? It seems like you would be an ideal person to talk to.
At first, I wondered why they hadn't. And then when I heard that they were examining 6 million original CIA documents, I thought, you know what? That's even better. Let them go to the primary sources.
So what was your reaction to the report when it came out? It was widely covered. You were in prison at the time. Some of the things coming out in the report, I'm sure you were already aware of. What else?
I was shocked at how many times investigators were able to document when CIA interrogators crossed that legal line, crossed the line of approved authorities, and carried out there's nothing else I can call it but torture techniques on prisoners. For example, this rectal hydration, rectal feeding. There was nothing in the president's signed order that allowed CIA officers to do such a thing. And besides, I've never heard, I'm not a doctor, but I've never heard of forcing hummus up a prisoner's rectum is somehow some form of hydration or feeding. That just didn't make any sense to me. Now, I did know about the cold cells. I did know about the sleep deprivation. And frankly, I thought that those techniques were even worse than the waterboarding, because there can be permanent psychological damage to prisoners who undergo those kinds of techniques.
Now, this president has also said that he intends to crack down on intelligence leaks. You're not the only intelligence officer to be targeted with prosecution. Some under the Espionage Act, you were targeted elsewhere in the law. What's your feeling about this administration that you hoped would be different, that has put you in jail and other intelligence officers under prosecution?
I've been shocked at the number of Espionage Act prosecutions under this administration. In the entirety of American history, from the very beginning of the Espionage Act in 1917, there had been only three prosecutions. Since President Obama has become president, there have been an additional 8 prosecutions under the Espionage Act, and almost every one of those has been for leaking to the press. I've never been of the belief that leaking information to the press is espionage.
John Kiriakou, there have been some calls in Washington for your pardon. Jim Moran's a former congressman from Virginia. I assume he's your congressman. He called you a hero and said you deserve a pardon. Have you had any reasonably high-level discussions with legal experts or politicians or anyone who's talking about championing your cause for a presidential pardon in this case?
First, let me say that I've not formally asked for a pardon. I hope to do that perhaps in 2016. And my attorneys are speaking with a number of senior staff members for several prominent senators. I probably shouldn't say more than that, but I've got my fingers crossed that something good will happen.
If you don't get a presidential pardon, you go forward as a convicted felon, correct?
Yes, that's correct. I've lost the right to vote. I've lost the right to own a firearm. I even lost my federal pension. So the cost has been very high for me.
What do you think now when you watch television and you see the horrific acts of ISIS, just the latest franchise of Islamist terror taking over in the Middle East, and you see them kill and torture their victims in orange jumpsuits? That seems like a direct advertisement at the United States.
It is, I think, a direct advertisement. Our torture program has resulted in an ease of recruitment for groups like ISIS or like Al-Qaeda. When they see videos from Guantanamo or they hear about torture programs, it makes it easier for them to market themselves in poor villages around the Middle East and recruit new young men to fight for them. That's the real problem.
I've seen you elsewhere say that you would do it all again. You would blow the whistle again. Would you go back to work for the CIA again if you had the chance to go back and work in the company?
as crazy as it might sound, yeah, I would. I loved the CIA. I had a very enjoyable and successful career there. I think that the CIA is largely made up of brave and patriotic and smart men and women. They do a good job. And yeah, I actually would go back to the CIA.
John Kiriakou is a retired CIA agent. He is currently under house arrest in Virginia, having just been released from prison in Pennsylvania, the only CIA officer to go to prison behind leaks and behind revelations of torture in the Bush administration. John Kiriakou, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
John Kiriakou didn't have freedom of speech, the government said, when it comes to revealing classified information. Well, our next guest is taking shots at the national security state, too, though not entirely from outside of it and with a very different set of tools than John Kiriakou used. Congressman Steve Israel is a Democratic congressman from New York's 3rd District. He's also author of The Global War on Morris. It's a political satire about the government's top secret surveillance program going out of control. And that's what happens when the most average and unsuspecting of guys, Long Island salesman Morris Feldstein, is targeted as a major terror threat. I talked to the congressman about how he managed, even as a member of Congress, to write a political satire. And we also talked about being at the center of the controversy over Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's invitation to speak before Congress in early March.
You know, 435 members of the House and 435 memoirs waiting to be written. I decided to take a different course. I've always enjoyed writing, and I decided to write a novel, a comic novel, a scathing parody of Washington, D.C. during the Bush administration and the global war on terror.
The book is The Global War on Morris. Who's Morris? He's your protagonist. Who is he?
Morris is a constituent on Long Island whose entire life's philosophy is don't make waves. Don't make trouble. Don't get involved. He doesn't watch the news. He doesn't listen to NYC. He watches the Mets and Turner Classic Movies because there's no tension, no anxiety. And through a glitch in the National Security Agency's surveillance program, he's actually suspected by Dick Cheney of becoming a major terrorist trying to take down the government of the United States of America. And that's the premise of this satire.
And we won't get into too many spoilers. Morris gets into some serious trouble, and it's a big madcap world of mistaken identity, and a lot of it's really funny, sort of about how the national security state invades lives. It exposes a lot of its folly. But there are some real notes here. You mentioned Dick Cheney. He's a character. Scooter Libby is in the story. The president, George W. Bush. NSA computers that track your calls and your contacts. That stuff is real. So you're going for some commentary here as well as just straight comedy.
You know, I would sit in on these classified briefings with Dick Cheney and President Bush and Rumsfeld and Rice. And the stuff I was hearing was so inane. But I realized if I had written a serious work of nonfiction on the things that I was hearing, nobody would buy it. And so I decided that the best way of making a point, of making that commentary, is through the tried and true techniques of satire.
Well, I want to ask you about that commentary because there are plenty of laughs in the book. But what's the polemic here? Is it against national security overreach? Is it against bureaucracy? Is it against fear-mongering? What's the underlying polemic of your story?
All of the above. Mm-hmm. You know, this country has had a wrestling match between privacy and liberty since the Alien Sedition Acts in the 1780s, 1790s. And what I try and do is take real-life events that I was a witness to, these classified briefings, the selection of Senator Ted Kennedy for the Do Not Fly list, the attempt to divert a plane carrying Cat Stevens, who was thought to be a major threat to the United States. I decided to take all of that and make the point about the overreach of government, the day-to-day mishaps of the Bush administration, and do it in a way that the reader would find humorous. And one of the things that I'm just delighted by is the reviews have talked about how, you know, there are laugh-out-loud moments in the book.
You know, there's plenty of satire here, but I'll tell you where it could have been stronger is if you, a Democrat and a partisan Democrat, would not have used George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Scooter Libby as your real-life fake characters, but you could have just as easily substituted the Obama administration in for this critique. I mean, NSA surveillance is still real. Bulk collection is still real. This is a president that supports them. This is a president that has supported many aspects of the national security state that you criticize in this book. It's one thing for you to go after George W. Bush, big surprise. You could have gone after Obama.
Well, actually, the book takes place from 2004 to 2008, and Obama wasn't on the scene. However, in fairness, there are actual quotes from President Obama in this book ascribed to others. And I'll give you an example. I was at an event with the president when somebody asked him about the NSA program, and he said, "We have safeguards. This government does not spy on its people." Well, I took that quote. It is in the book. It's just ascribed to somebody else because President Obama wasn't on the scene in the White House during the time that the book deals with.
And I want to ask you about Morris Feldstein because he's your protagonist and your mistaken victim. And he's a good one. He's a schlubby, kind of nebbishy, great neck Jewish guy. He's a pharmaceutical salesman. Like you said, he never makes waves.
Right.
He's the one least likely in our culture to get rolled up by the NSA or the FBI or whoever else. But, you know, a lot of Muslims reading this book might say, "Israel, not funny. This is real for us. NSA surveillance, mistaken identity, no fly lists, profiling.
Right.
It's one thing for you to choose, you know, a white Jewish middle class guy from Great Neck. It's not really very funny to us. This is part of our reality."
I think they would actually support the book and actually have gotten great feedback from many. And here's why. The point I'm making is, this could happen to a white, middle-aged Jewish guy in Great Neck. And if it can happen to him, it can happen to anyone. And if you feel any sympathy towards poor old Morris Feldstein, then consider how many Morris Feldsteins may be out there and think about what's happening to them.
Has Vice President Dick Cheney read your book?
If I'm missing for more than 3 days, I would ask him first where I am.
That's right. Well, the book is The Global War on Morris. The author is Congressman Steve Israel, who represents the 3rd District in New York. Let's shift to something current in Congress right now. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech before Congress is controversial, largely because he was invited directly by John Boehner, the Speaker of the House. That's been controversial among a lot of your Democratic colleagues. You've sort of been at the center of this. I want to ask you about it first. Let's listen to Speaker Boehner, who was on the Sunday talk shows this past weekend, answering for some of the criticism.
There's no secret here in Washington about the animosity that this White House has for Prime Minister Netanyahu. I frankly didn't want them getting in the way and quashing what I thought was a real opportunity.
That's from Fox News Sunday. And the speaker says he didn't want the White House getting in the way. What's the crux of this problem? It seems to a lot of us that the crux of it is not necessarily giving Netanyahu a platform. It's that the speaker went around the State Department and the White House and is essentially conducting diplomacy.
Well, by the way, you know, what we just heard is, I think, the 17th version of events that the speaker has given. This just does not pass the consistency test. Look, let me speak uncharacteristically bluntly for a member of Congress. What the speaker did is a political trap. I'm not a big believer in walking into traps. This was designed by the Speaker of the House to try and politicize Israel, to make Israel a political football, to drive a wedge between the United States and Israel. Why would I let him get away with that? Look, I tend to lean to the right on U.S.-Israeli relations. I think that the deal with Iran is shaping up to be a bad deal. I'm going to go to the speech. But let's not believe for a moment that the speaker's motivations were anything but brutally political, and he has done a disservice to the relationship between the United States and Israel and a disservice to the state of Israel. And that's why this was so badly done.
But we'll all cover the speech on March 3rd, of course, when Benjamin Netanyahu speaks in front of a joint session. The congressman is Steve Israel. He's a Democrat from the 3rd District of New York. His book is The Global War on Morris, in bookstores now. Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you.
The recent attacks at a kosher market in Paris and outside of a synagogue in Copenhagen have many European Jews worried about rising anti-Semitism across the continent. And those aren't the only incidents. A Jewish cemetery in eastern France was defaced over the weekend. Some Jews have already left Europe. Last year, more than 7,000 French Jews migrated to Israel. That's double the number from the year before. And Israel is preparing for an influx. This week, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu approved a $46 million special budget to help finance the cost of absorbing new immigrants from France and Belgium and Ukraine. And Netanyahu directly addressed European Jews in a statement this week.
We call upon the Jews, our brothers and sisters. Israel is your home. We are preparing to absorb a mass immigration from Europe. Jews of Europe, Jews of the world, I say Israel is waiting for you with open arms.
But a lot of people see that statement as opportunism, arguing that European Jews have a right to be protected in their home countries, and that their home countries and their leaders have to do more to fight anti-Semitism. Joining us is Rabbi Menachem Margolin, Director General of the European Jewish Association. Rabbi, welcome.
Hello. Good to talk to you.
You reacted pretty strongly to the Prime Minister's remarks.
Yeah, well, basically, this call to come to Israel became an automatic response of Israeli governments every time something happened in Europe. And this is unacceptable because calling Jews to come to Israel after each attack is basically saying that there is no way to protect them where they are. And it's unacceptable. The Jewish people who decide to live in Europe or wherever they decide to live have the full right to full with a full freedom of religion and with a full security.
Netanyahu made a similar statement after the attacks at Charlie Hebdo and the kosher market in Paris. He repeated them after the attack at the synagogue in Copenhagen earlier this week. Right. Do you see the statement from the prime minister as opportunism on his part, political opportunism? He's in a re-election campaign after all.
Prime Minister Netanyahu and many others have another point of view. Their point of view is that Jewish people grow up with, and actually it's in our blood, that it's for 2,000 of years we are a target, especially in Europe. For 2,000 years, maybe over, Jewish people knew that they need always to run away from dangerous. So this is in our blood that when there is a dangerous, we have to find another protected place. And so what Prime Minister Netanyahu point of view, as many other Israelis, and by the way, many other Jews around the world feel, that is a one country that will do everything possible forever to protect Jews. So what he means is saying, look, if governments in Europe prove so many times that they are unable to protect you where you are, so come to Israel.
What is your assessment, Rabbi Margolin, of the state, if I can ask it this way, of anti-Semitism in Europe? Sensitivities are high, and rightfully so, after the experiences of World War II and even the many decades before. Is the crux of anti-Semitism now in Europe a part of rising, in some sectors, Islamist sentiment? Does it come from the native Europeans? Assess where you think it is right now.
First of all, I think it would be important to remember that anti-Semitism was existing in Europe for thousands of years before the Muslims immigrated to Europe. And if you look today, the most anti-Semitic countries are countries where you don't have almost Islam population there, like Ukraine, like Poland, like Greece, and maybe other countries, Hungary, that they can maybe put on a list. So I don't agree with those who just try to blame only the Islam for that. But if you ask what is the situation in Europe, I can tell you that we see lately a dramatic increase with the level of anti-Semitism in Europe. And indeed, the situation became very dangerous and very unpleasant for Jewish people all over Europe.
What is your assessment of the reaction of some of the leaders in Europe so far? There were strong statements from François Hollande in France, from Angela Merkel in Germany. The Prime Minister of Denmark made a statement saying that Jews were an integral part of Denmark. What did you think of those statements?
so far from the names you mentioned, the only one I can say that really do what they can to protect Jews and to give them the great feeling possible is Anglo-America and Germany. And all the other countries, I do appreciate those statements, but we are fed half with statements, I'm sorry to say, because every time something happens, we hear strong statements from governments, but this is just not enough. Each Jewish institution, as of kindergarten and school and synagogue and museum, community centers and kosher supermarket, should be protected 24/7. This is the responsibility of the government to ensure the Jewish people in Europe will be able to live with a full security.
Do you think, Rabbi Menachem Margolin, that it's really possible to physically protect each of these institutions in each of these countries, especially with the kind of threat that we appear to be seeing, which is a homegrown French or Danish or Belgian person who wants to make an attack on their own and get a gun could undertake it in May? Those are the types of attacks that we've seen. Is it practical for the government to secure all of these institutions like you're asking?
If the government will follow our instruction of what can be done to fight against anti-Semitism, it wouldn't be needed for a long term. This is something that's needed right now for a short term because of the situation. But if the government in Europe will understand that the level of anti-Semitism require completely different attention and they will create a special authority to fight against anti-Semitism, there's a lot of things that could be done.
Before I let you go, Rabbi, you're in Brussels, correct, in Belgium?
Right.
What does it mean to you to be able to stay in your city and not go to Israel, to be able to stay where you live?
So leaders of Jewish communities must stay in Europe till even one Jew will remain in Europe. We still have to be here to serve them, to give them all the community services this Jew will need. So the leaders of Jewish communities for sure are not allowed to leave the continent, but we will stay here as much as it is needed.
A lot of Jews in Europe are pushing back against the statement from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu inviting them to migrate to Israel. Rabbi Menachem Margolin is one of them. He's Director General of the European Jewish Association. Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you very much.
The Oscars are on Sunday, and all this week we're taking a closer look at some of the films that are nominated for Best Picture with the film's directors, writers, and target audience members. You're weighing in with your nominations.
This is Blaine from San Antonio. I think Wes Anderson deserves the Oscar. Grand Budapest was engaging and unique, and I think it's his finest work to date.
Good choice, Blaine. But today, we're going to take a look at the film that tells the story of Stephen Hawking, not just as a great physicist, but as a husband in a marriage that faced its share of challenges.
Leave me now.
Are you going to talk about this or not?
Can you just go?
Is that what you want?
Yes, it is what I want, so please, if you care about me at all, then please just go.
I can't.
I have 2 years to live. I need to work.
I love you.
You've left a false conclusion.
Kristen Meinzer of the Movie Date podcast interviewed James Marsh, director of The Theory of Everything. Marsh began by explaining what drew him to the story and why, despite being a celebrated documentary filmmaker, he decided to shoot the film as a drama.
One of the reasons I wanted to make the film was it wasn't a biography of Stephen Hawking and didn't attempt to be. It was a portrait of a relationship and a marriage. And that was, for me, much more interesting territory than a conventional biography. And I felt that actually, as a documentary filmmaker by background, in fact, a screenplay, a dramatic film, was a good way of exploring that part of his life in a way that you couldn't really with a documentary because you wouldn't have been there to document that marriage. And also, I was very intrigued by Jane Wilde, who became Jane Hawking, and the fact that the screenplay and the story we were telling gave her an equal voice. And that felt to me to be the most important aspect of it in a way, to have a perspective from the person who cared for him and enabled many aspects of his life to continue as they did.
Now, Jane Wilde, this is actually inspired by her memoir, is that right?
That's correct. This film was inspired by her second memoir, which was written quite a bit after they separated and divorced and had, a more generous perspective on the relationship. And I met with Jane several times before we made the film and went on a very interesting tour around Cambridge with her, where she was able to point out all the many impediments that she would encounter with Stephen and three children and how difficult it was at that time to get around Cambridge. And she almost single-handedly made Cambridge a friendly place for disabled people.
She seems in this movie like an incredible woman. And Stephen Hawking also seems like an incredible human, but not perfect. He seemed to display all the vast types of emotions and contradictions that we as humans display when we're in relationships.
Indeed, and the relationship ends in failure, essentially. There's much to celebrate and enjoy about their steadfastness together. But like so many other relationships, it doesn't endure. And so, yes, it does try and show you an accurate portrait. But both Jane and Stephen separately have said that they find it to be broadly true.
And Stephen, he actually played a role in this movie, which we don't necessarily see, but we hear. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, well, we met with Stephen before the film went into production and got his approval for the screenplay. I'm not sure he was wild about the idea, given the provenance of the story, which was his ex-wife's memoir. Mm-hmm. But he was able to understand that it was a dramatic film and was taking his story and telling it in very broad strokes. He came to the film set when we were working on the film in Cambridge, and I think enjoyed the scale of what we were doing. He came when the May Ball scene in the film was being staged. And then towards the end of the production, we had to show him the film, and that was obviously a very nerve-wracking occasion. And also it takes him quite a while to communicate, so after the screening was over, we had to wait quite a while, given the nature of how he communicates with his voice, to understand what he made of it. But his proclamation was that he found it to be broadly true, and then volunteered his actual voice for us to use in the film. So he became almost a character in the film at that point. He was already, of course, in a fictional, dramatic way. But the voice made a big difference to the way the film worked for me personally, and it changed the film in a very mysterious way. So the voice you hear in the film is, in fact, Stephen's voice. And that felt like an endorsement to the film, too, that he was able to offer that to us.
James Marsh, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
James Marsh is the Oscar-winning director of Man on Wire, also Project Nim, and the new film, The Theory of Everything.
Well, tomorrow the Westminster Dog Show is on, and we've got Sarah Montague to tell us who is best in show. Now, your pups might not make the cut, but we still love them. Tweet us a photo of your dog at The Takeaway with the proud hashtag WestminsterReject. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillig for John Hockenberry, who is back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.